when I got through that first year, and I remember a few friends saying, right, what is it? What are we going to do? Are we going to go out? Or a few friends even said, we'll go on holiday when you start drinking again. And, you know, people who are just know you for being a certain person. I then went through in the second year, the first 6 months of that second year, grieving an old me. I think when you start standing up for what you want in life and really going for the life that you want, there's a period that there's a void that's lonely. You get lonely because it means that you have to outgrow certain people who have been by your side a long time.
Hi everybody, welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Suzanne Shaw is a singer, actress, and a performance coach who gained fame from the pop band Hearsay on Pop Stars. She later starred in musical theatre and TV, winning Dancing on Ice in 2008. In 2020, Suzanne shifted to focus on to health and well-being, becoming a life coach and an advocate for mental well-being. We had a brilliant conversation, really open, honest, about the film we starred in together 10 years ago, about the integral three C's of sobriety and the hardest part of Suzanne's sobriety journey, which I'll let her tell you about. Suzanne, thank you so much for coming on This Is Powerful.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. I know you, and obviously an incredible singer, but I know you as an actress because we did a movie together.
We did.
Well, it was supposed to be a series, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But what I remember is one night we went to a pub there, and I would have been probably 10 years sober.
That long?
Yeah.
Do you know, I had no idea you were sober, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it that bad?
No, it was just that, I don't know, I don't remember having a conversation about it. I don't know whether you, I don't think you brought it up.
Well, I did to the director, because at the bar, in one of the scenes, everyone was drinking, and I won't name who it was going behind the bar and actually drinking real stuff, right?
Oh, really?
I don't remember that bit.
If I did, I would have joined in.
Oh, right.
But I don't think I did, though.
They were getting hammered. They was doing real stuff, which was fun. And it was part of what we was doing and part of the scene. But I was really like, just make sure whatever I has no alcohol in it.
Yeah.
So I must have said it really sneakily.
Were you open about it or not? Because
Yeah, do you know what? I never walk around and say to everyone I'm sober.
Yeah.
And I never preach to anyone. I never done anything like that. But Keith Duffy, who'd done it with us, asked me, he's like, should we go for a beer? And I was like, yeah, we can go out, but I don't really drink. And he's like, really?
Mm.
I was like, yeah, I don't drink alcohol. So we had a little chat about it.
Right, okay.
But I remember you being particularly sensible because we went to this pub.
Yeah.
And everyone was getting quite hammered. Yeah. And at the time, I lived in Marylebone around the corner and I was getting a bit like, I'm going to leave soon.
Yeah.
And I said to you, are you going anywhere after? Do you want to go somewhere? And you said, no, I'm going home, getting the train home. And I was like, wow, she's really cool and like calm. So I never saw anything.
You must have got me on like a day I was probably taking a break from alcohol. See, that's what I used to do though. I wasn't somebody who would drink, I'd say that I would drink a lot and a lot of the time, but I'd have big breaks because I knew it didn't suit me. And so maybe I might have just thought I'll take it easy and I need to go home. But I do recall, didn't I have my son with me on one day?
In Soho.
Yeah. Yeah.
One day in Soho. That wasn't that day.
Day. All right. So maybe I just had to get back because, I don't know, the nanny was going home or,
I was like, wow, good on her. Like, well done.
Really?
Meanwhile, you went somewhere else.
Meanwhile, down the road, I had a new group of friends.
Yeah, when I went, she went, everyone, come here. I had a different view of you from what you've been sharing online. Really? And you're very open about mental health, well-being.
Yeah.
Which is really admirable, because I think it takes courage to talk about it, but it helps a lot of people.
I know. Sometimes I still get a little bit fearful about how open I am, but I try to embrace that. It's a really big thing for me to do that, because I think vulnerability is power. I think it's powerful. And I know when I see other people being vulnerable, I have nothing but the highest respect. And I also think, God, you've really helped me by being vulnerable. So thank you. So I always try, even when I have moments. I was on the Vanessa show the other day, and I was really honest about something I'd never been honest about before. And I went to stop to say the sentence that I'd said. And I thought, why are you stopping? This is when you have to step out of your comfort zone now. You have to be honest. You have to just tell your truth. And so, yeah, as much as sometimes I have these moments, which I call my no moments, where I'm stood in a supermarket, I go and grab a tin of tomatoes and I think, no, why did I say that? I just go, you're doing good. It's okay. It's all right.
Being in the media, we spoke about it earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Being exposed to certain things, I never wanted to talk about anything.
No?
Ever. But they put, I had, and this was another paper which was settled a few years ago, had put like, Cocaine Paul goes to Hollywood and da-da-da. and that went into American news and went everywhere.
Yeah.
And my parents didn't really even know what cocaine was. They had no idea. And no one knew that I had issues around drugs and drink. And that just buried, a lot of, it caused so many problems, basically.
Yeah.
I was gonna say it buried me, but it caused a lot of problems. But I feel now that because of my charity, I'm using it as a strength.
Yeah.
So I'm open about it.
I think as well, the landscape's changed a little bit on how private people are now. I know when I was back in Hearsay, it was very much you say very little.
Yeah.
You're media trained and you have your go-to lines that if you don't want to continue, you would just say something else and then move on to the next thing. Whereas now I think sharing is really like a great way to be able to connect, and for either your audience or your community or your fans to be able to see you in real life.
Yeah.
I think it's very different now.
So how was your upbringing?
So I was brought up in a working class family. I grew up in a place called Ratcliffe, which is just outside of Manchester. So my dad was an aspiring footballer. He wanted to be a footballer. And that kind of didn't work out because he preferred the booze rather than the training.
Right.
So he liked to go to the pub after a training session rather than go home, keep fit and continue on his path to becoming a footballer. And so that kind of went very quickly for him. And then, he fell into kind of photography and camera work. And then me and my brother used to dance when we were kids.
You started early, right?
Started really early, 3.5 years old. As soon as I was out of nappies, my mum was like, well, it was 2.5. So we went to dance school, and my dad saw a gap in the market. He was quite entrepreneurial, actually. And he was filming me doing my dance at this dance festival. And one of the dads came up to him and said, would you mind filming my daughter? And I'll pay you for the tape. And he was like, what a great business idea this is. So he just set up shop in every dance festival around the country.
Amazing.
Went to the dance schools, local dance schools, I'll film. And then, paid for the VHSs. And then it went to CDs. And now it's like impossible to make any money out of that. And so that was his life. And my mum was a mental health nurse at Prestwich Hospital, which is quite a famous psychiatric ward. My parents had a very vulnerable relationship, lots of arguing, mainly because my dad drank a lot. And his drinking habits probably was to the detriment of their marriage. And that ended when I was about 14, 15. And I remember my mum saying to me and your dad are going to split up. And I'm thinking, thank God, because cannot deal with the arguing. And it was a very hard environment to live in. And so I was thrilled about it. My mum and dad, both brilliant, brilliant people. But yeah, my dad just, he did have a problem with alcohol.
Yeah.
And eventually, I think that potentially was a big part of his illness, because he ended up getting a brain tumour and he passed away in 2012. And I think his lifestyle played a big part in, you know, a lot of his health issues. Well, I remember when he was going through treatment, he wanted to still drink, and you're not meant to drink on chemo. And they warned him. They said, if you continue drinking, we're going to stop the treatment because it's not going to work.
Yeah.
And he would ask me to get him a gin, just go and get me a gin and tonic. And the hard thing is, he was stage four, it was terminal, he was going to die. It was just how long that would be. And he had a bucket list of things that he wanted to do. And we were at that fight stage of going, do we allow him just to live his life, or do we try our best to see if this is going to work for him, to let him live longer?
It's a hard place to be.
And I remember getting him a tonic. So I filled it up with tonic. Go and get me a gin and tonic. So I filled tonic, and then I'd put my finger in the gin and put it around the rim of the glass to think that he was having it. And he knew. It's like, this hasn't got bloody gin
what
in it.
Kind
what
of
are
gin
you doing?
Is
put gin in it. but yeah, I do. I now see where my unhealthy relationship with alcohol came from.
I have the opposite experience, in the sense of, we had loads of heavy drinking around us. It was just a normal thing. Moments of drinking in my family caused the same thing, vulnerability and like crazy arguments and stuff. And I've got a great relationship with my dad now, and he's a really cool guy, but at times it was awful.
Yeah.
And and basically I swore I would never drink.
Really?
Yeah.
I can understand that. And I think, you know what life and the stress and the chaos that it brings. And I now can appreciate as an adult, when I looked at that as a child, looking at my dad, like, why is he so temperamental? You know, add that with the peer pressure of being an entrepreneur, having your own business, making sure you're meeting the bills, and then drink on top of that. You can understand why, how volatile people can get off it. And I can understand him so much more now. But I was very confused as a child on why that was such a big part of his life. Because my mum very rarely drinks. Like, she'll have one, she'll giggle, she'll get rosy cheeks, and then that'll be her done for the evening. Like, she never really touched a drop, and neither did my grandparents on my mum's side. But my dad's side, they were drinking whiskey in the morning, Guinness, and, you know, it was Irish blood.
When did you take your first drink?
I think about 10. There was Malibu on the top of the fridge, and it was Christmas. And I just loved the coconut smell of Malibu. But I literally had a sip. So that was the first time I tried it. Because I wanted to be an adult, don't you, at a young age? Because when you're a kid, you play mums and dads and, you know, like going to work and being a business person, you know, all of those. It's
well,
part
you aspire
of the,
to be an adult, don't you? Yeah. Do an adult thing.
Yeah. So, but properly, like, peer pressure wise, 14, was when I started to drink and then try and get fake ID and go into the pubs and the clubs. And 15, I was at this place called Roxy in Bury, the Roxy, and could get in easily, no questions asked, and, you know, make sure you kind of, it kind of worked out quite well when my parents split up, because I took full advantage of my dad loving to go out all night drinking. And so on the weekends that my dad would have me, that would be the weekends I'd go, well, he's not going to be back. He might not even be back all night. So we can go to the Roxy, we can go out, or we can have a party at his house and invite everyone round. And I remember my dad looking in the wheelie bin and going, bloody hell, they've been on the hard stuff. Because we've been drinking like vodka and like proper spirits at this party. But yeah, it was a big part of that kind of northern culture growing up.
I love the way you said, though, through peer pressure. Can you tell us about peer pressure?
Well, I always felt a little bit out of it. I was a child performer, so I started performing really young. So I got my first professional job when I was 9, and then I got into a TV show when I was 12. And I grew up at a state school, you know. I wasn't in any private, like, drama school or colleges or anything like that. And so I would do my TV work, and then I'd have to go into a school outside of Manchester, and you can imagine, like, that I'm not going to be all that popular. I'm going to get bullied, and people were going to try and put me back in my place. And so to fit in, I would go down the lane have a cigarette and be the person to try and get the booze. So I would be able to, so I wasn't the performer and I wasn't the person who thought they were better than everybody else because I was on TV.
It's quite actually a smart way in the sense of to understand the dynamics and want to be part of something and not
survival.
Stand out. Yeah,
it's survival. Yeah. You know, I was trying to survive at a school that I was a complete alien in, like they'd never had that before.
Yeah.
You know, a kid just suddenly become there on the TV and that was tough going to survive in that. And I remember looking at going to Italia Conte, and that was a place that my parents were like, maybe you're better off going there. So we tried to get a scholarship. But I didn't like being away from home. The thought of going into an environment with other performers who were, you know, I found quite intimidating, scared me. Yeah. At that age. And so I would
it's hard.
I think had I lived in London and been down the road from my parents, it would have been a different story, but to board there at that age,
that's a lot.
Yeah, so I kind of grin and bear it and just kind of became try to fit in with the cool kids.
It's sad really, isn't it, because if you're shining and you've got an incredible talent, which you have, and you kind of got to make yourself smaller to fit in.
Yeah, to survive, isn't it? To survive, that's to fit in, to survive. So, and that's, I think that's really tough in life, in every environment, even if you're an adult, you know, you're in a work environment, if you're excelling. And it, isn't it funny how the cool people are the people who kind of downplay everything?
100%.
You know, don't be so successful. The cool people are go and have the beer.
It's definitely a British thing. I spent 20 years in America.
Right, okay.
I think America's built on sales, so it's easy just to sell something and say something and it not be, over here we're like, what are you trying to, what's the deal, what's going on?
Yeah.
A bit more suspicious.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I think it's a complete different, I think it's just a cultural thing.
I often think that, you know, would I personally feel more comfortable in a place like America where it's okay to try and strive and like you say, be salesy about yourself and be, you know, I don't know. It's, I find it interesting.
When did you feel that there was a problem? Because obviously you started very early and you had a massive public arrival again, more right with Hearsay and pop stars and stuff like that. How did that affect you? Because if you was trying to fit in with the guys at school that were doing the naughty stuff, how did that affect you as you went through that stage?
So there was this really strange period of my life where I fit in with the kids at school, and then we went to college, and there was that other dynamic. And then when I got into the band, I didn't actually drink all that much. I just kind of got into the kind of drinking scene because of school and college, and occasionally smoking a bit of weed, which never agreed with me, so that was never my thing. Never ended up going down that road. But there was this kind of like period of my life where I almost went quite clean. I'd said like, I never want to smoke again, that's it. You know, I did that whole trying to fit in for a little while, but then that kind of went away.
Especially if you're singing, it's probably a great excuse not to.
And my dance teachers smoked around us, and I never liked being around a smoky environment. So that kind of went away for a little while. And when we got into the band, the boys loved to go to the pub. But the girls, we never drank. Like, we were working 24/7. There was no time. There was zero time within that kind of 2 years we were together as a band to drink. We did end up smoking because the boys smoked, and we were just in this cloud of smoke in our people carrier, and we're like, we might as well just join him.
Like cheek and chomp.
And in actual fact, we ended up smoking. I know I certainly did, to lose weight, keep slim,
so I wouldn't eat as
much.
It's such an old myth.
But I
wouldn't eat. So many models do that.
Yeah, I wouldn't eat as much because I would fill the void, the food noise, with a cigarette.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of that going on. And then it was towards kind of the end of Hearsay where we started to go to the VIP nights. So like the Pops and Gary and Glenn running their scintillate nights and going to all the clubs. And so, you get the free drink and stuff. But even then, I never found it was a problem. It was kind of like after the band. I don't know. Again, it was about playing that game of that time, that era of it was cool to fall out of a nightclub drunk. It kind of fit what the trend was for that time.
Well, you're more of a legend. You're more in the game. Yeah. You're more somebody in that way, in a weird, perverse way.
So again, it was that, oh, is that what I have to do to fit in? Again, it's that peer pressure. There's probably like this theme of like, I am just doing what I feel like I need to fit into the masses.
Yeah.
So basically, I drank a bit, but I'm young. I can handle it. It wasn't a problem. I then, after Hearsay, went into a musical and we were drinking every night.
Was that Joseph?
That was a summer holiday.
All right.
And that was we had time to drink because we sleep in the day, do performance at night. Young vocals could hack it, you know, everything was great. You know, you could still go on and do a show. And that was actually quite a big boozy show. And then what I realised is actually the theatre world is quite a boozy world.
I know, right?
Yeah, it's mental. And I didn't think it was a problem because I'm around people who were equally drinking the same amount. So, and because I could sustain my job, it was never a problem until I kind of hit early 30s. And that's when I was not handling the aftermath of it.
So how, when you went into your 30s, how did drinking change?
I was just probably boozing more and more, and using it to be able to cope with overstimulating environments. So after show parties, I could never do anything like that sober. You know, like, I found that very, very difficult. So to kind of regulate my emotions, drinking was a great thing to turn to. And I remember thinking, early 30s, end of 20s, early 30s, thinking I might have a real issue with alcohol, like an unhealthy relationship with alcohol when I was in Emmerdale.
Yeah.
And I remember I could never just have the one. So once I had one, it was like, I've just got to continue because, like, you know, I just couldn't just stop at that. I just had to continue the party. And sometimes that would be a party for one. Like, so we'd go out for a meal.
Did you know that then, or was that hindsight?
No, I probably subconsciously knew that then. Yeah, maybe more hindsight. But I think there was one time I was in Emmerdale and we'd been out for a meal. We'd had a few drinks, gone back home, and we had some drinks in. And I couldn't stop. I just had to have another drink when I got back.
Yeah.
And I had a really big shoot the next day. But for whatever reason, I didn't stop and I missed my wake-up call. I slept through my alarm.
Oh, how was that?
Awful. I was mortified.
Yeah.
Absolutely mortified, because that's just like a no-go, an absolute no-go. And I just remember thinking, I've never been that unprofessional in my career. I've always like been on it and wanted to do my absolute best. I love my job. And I'll never forget just really letting down. And that cost money to not be on set at that time. And then thinking I had a week off and I was like, I'm just not drinking. I'm taking a break from alcohol because I'm mortified that's happened. But it happened to so many people in the industry who didn't show up on set. So it wasn't really, again, it was like, oh, it's what happens. But I just remember just being internally mortified that I did that.
Because it's kind of like, it's like a moral line you cross,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I had that. I was doing a big Versace campaign in the States, and we was at Chateau Marmont.
Mm.
And there was a guy from London who was over and was like, let's have a couple of drinks. We had to be up. We had a call time, I think, at 6.
Yeah.
I was like, I'll go for one. He's like, I've never been to a strip bar. Will you take me? I was like, well, there is one over the road. I don't really want to go, but let's just go and see.
Yeah.
We rolled in at like 5:30, absolutely wasted.
Mm.
I remember saying, oh, God, I've got 20 minutes. Shall I have a coffee now? Shall I have a shower? Coffee, shower. I'll lay down for 5 minutes. Then I'll have a shower and I'll go. Mm. I woke up at 7 o'clock, people banging on the door. Paul, where are you? What are you doing? I was supposed to be the main person for the shoot in the morning.
Yeah.
I laid. There's a photograph of me laying on an F-150 pickup truck with dark glasses on, completely asleep as part of the campaign. Because I was so battered that I just laid on there. And I missed like literally the first half of the shoot.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was mortified because no matter what, I always respected the photographer, the team, everybody,
yeah,
because
yeah, yeah.
it's a massive production. Like yeah. what you said for Remedy, it costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they was doing group shots. I think Mila Jovovich was the girl in there, and
yeah.
So they did some singles for group shots, and then they was kind of like, "Are you ready?" But it wasn't. It wasn't a good day.
No, I get that. Oh, I get that. And you just feel mortified. And then that picture, it always reminds you of that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have that moment when I've seen myself in Emmerdale thinking, I know what happened the night before. I was hammered. And that for me was the point where I was like, I've definitely got an unhealthy relationship with alcohol. I never got to addiction point. Now, whether that's naive of me to say, maybe that was addiction. But I would take big breaks. So after that point of being yeah. totally mortified, I had like a month off alcohol and I was like, I'm not doing it. Felt amazing, got into great shape. And then it was peer pressure again. And it was, just have the one drink. And then, you know, I just carried on just making sure that I'd always still show up no matter what. And maybe it was a functioning alcoholic. Maybe I was. But I definitely had this ability to be able to be very disciplined when I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, for me, I stopped and didn't look back. I didn't go into a rehab. I didn't need to have therapy around it. I just was like, I can't do this because it's not suiting and serving my mental health and my personality.
Yeah.
And I just knew I'm just not anybody who can ever moderate. And I have to accept that the one will always turn into a great night out.
Which is great knowledge for yourself.
Yeah.
I don't think everyone has to go in rehab. And I don't think, I think there's levels and it's up to the person to say, are you
yeah.
addicted to alcohol? Do you have a habit? Are you yeah. just functioning alcoholic? Or are you just a heavy drinker?
Yeah.
It's up to the person to say that. And I think yeah. I think there are grades like, I know I got off the lift in time before it went down to the basement. I'm
yeah.
sure there was another floor for me.
Yeah.
I'm happy where I got off.
Yeah.
And people, I know I've got friends.
It's a really good way of saying it. It's a really great way of saying it.
Yeah, because I do yeah. look at it as an elevator. Once I was at a penthouse and I was going down and down and down.
Yeah.
And I think I got off at the first floor. I definitely got off in time.
I've been doing this research into archetypes at the moment and it really makes sense why I did and what archetype that they call them, the bard, the wizard, the jester and the warrior. And I'm very much a bard, which is I go with the energy of the room. So that's why I'm a performer. That's why I people please. It's why I'll say yes to lots of things because yeah. I have to go with the energy of the room because of my archetype. It's my natural state. It's why I have to be on stage. It's why I like to perform. It's like, you know, just part of my personality.
Yeah.
And then like there's the warrior that is the person who fights for justice and will do all they can and they're the servers of the world. And then the jesters are the free, lucky-go, happy people. And then you've got the wizards who are the studious people. Now, we'll all have those different archetypes yeah. within our personality, but you'll have one natural one. And for me, when I was reading this book, I was like, that's why the industry that I was in didn't help with my mental health because I would often go to these after-show parties and would have this overwhelming feeling of I have to fit in. It's really important for me to fit in. And yeah. to fit in, I have to go with the crowd who are, you know, doing whatever.
Interesting.
It's really
have some wizard.
Yeah.
Or what was the one? What was it called?
Bard. The bard.
I definitely yeah. have bard.
Yeah.
And the warrior. Yeah. It's interesting to see. What I do now is that I can tune in and tune out.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
a very
which is great.
Weird thing to yeah. experience because it's obviously a personal thing. Because I'm the same. If I used to go and watch a comedy film, then I think I'm a comedian. If I
yep.
watched a gangster film, I'd walk slower, talk out the side
exactly.
of my mouth,
exactly.
drive
yeah.
differently.
Yeah.
Literally would become what's going on.
Yeah.
And I call it just being a chameleon.
Yeah.
And whether it'd be fitting in, if it was a hostile environment, I'd be hostile.
Yeah.
I could really people please.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I never was be able to do, could do before was to stand in my center.
Yeah.
So what happened when you said, I'm done?
Well, when I said I'm done, and was probably around about 2017. And I was like, right, I need to get out of this drinking culture. I need out. How do I do it? So I think I did a Sober October, and then it got into November and I couldn't keep it up, so I went back to drinking. And then 2019, I do a dry January, which then went on to a dry April, May. I did really long, and I was like, I think I've nailed it. I did my first holiday sober, and I was like, I was feeling amazing. I was working out every morning. I was running on the beach. I just felt incredible. And I remember that moment just being such a pinnacle moment in my sober journey. Of going, this is how I want to live my life. And now I've cracked it. And then I got home and it was my partner's best friend's wedding. And there was quite a few people in the industry that I knew. And I got there and I thought, and I hadn't committed to what I was going to do, whether I was going to drink or not. Because I said I'd do this kind of sober dry January that had gone on for 3 or 4 months. And I hadn't worked it out in my head. I hadn't committed to it. And so I was easily persuaded to have a drink. And then that summer, I think I was having one last massive blowout because I drank and drank and drank. I must have just smelled of white wine for like 6 months. Like, God knows what conversations I had, where I ended up, but it was almost like I was ready, but I just needed to just have one last hurrah. Yeah. And then at the end of 2019, I was like, oh God, I'm burnt out here. I have gone big time. I did have time off again for Sober October because I was doing a play and it was a 3-woman play and we had to be on it. It was a comedy and there was a lot of words and we had to remember a lot. So I didn't drink for that period and felt amazing. And I'd started my plant-based journey at that point as well. And yeah, I just thought, I've got to do this for myself. And I was gearing up to do this 1 year no beer, which is a thing that you can do online. Yeah. But I didn't actually do online stuff, but my friend told me all about it and she'd done it and she said it was brilliant. And so I kind of dipped in and out of knowing what it was about and joining the community side of it. And I announced to my friends, I'm going to do this 1 year no beer. I remember actually the moment I was in Barbados. I'd been doing this one woman show on the cruise ships where you'd sing and tell a little bit of story of your life. Yeah. In the Limelight Lounge on the P&O cruises. It's a great little gig actually. And I did the Christmas between Boxing Day and New Year on the ship. And then I got off in Barbados and celebrated the New Year in Barbados. And so I was lying on the beach and I turned to my partner and we'd had a really heavy night. And I said, as soon as we get home, which was the 4th of January, I said, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm done. And he'd heard it a lot of times, me saying that, but I just knew. And the only way I could commit to this was to say to all my friends and family, I'm doing 1 year no beer. I really need your support. I want to just get through this entire year without drinking. And so did dry January. When my partner supported me and did dry January, we went to the pub on the 1st of Feb and he had a celebratory pint where he thought, oh, I'm just going to have a drink because I've got through January. And I was partly tempted, but I'd gone back to that time where I hadn't committed to myself. And so before we went to the pub, I wrote the list of things that I needed to say and what I needed to order when I got to the pub.
Smart.
And so I made a commitment to myself before I went out. So there was no sitting on the fence. There was no, what shall I get? Oh, you've not got a ginger beer then. Oh, go on, I'll have a white wine. There was no kind of toying with the idea. Yeah. And I really, I almost journaled this promise to myself, you're not going to have a drink. And I really dug my heels in. And I remember surviving it and going, great, okay, we're going to get through like another month. And then every time before I went out, I did this mini commitment to myself. And
did you hear about that from somewhere?
No. And I've created now these 3 C's around taking a break from alcohol, which now is a part of my coaching method in every area of my life. And those 3 C's are commitment. It's making that commitment to yourself. And whether that's journaling, whether it's daily mantras, whether it's announcing it to friends and family. Then consistency is just taking those small steps. And my consistency was a promise that I was going to prioritize my well-being every single day. That was my consistency. And that was to not drink, but then that was to do small things like running, working out, eating well. And then my third one was community. And I strangely never really had a strong community before. Because you know what show business is like. Yeah. Is it really a community? Do people really have your backs, or are they going to kill their own grandmothers to get that part over you, or to make sure that they are winning? You know, there's not much
probably
of that.
Letter.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so I had shied away from any kind of community before in hobbies, because I never did hobbies, because you'd walk into a room and people would want to know about your life, or a story would be sold on you. And yeah. So it was a very lonely place being famous. So in order to survive, I knew I had to start speaking to the sober community. And I also spoke to the running community and the plant-based community. All of the things that were keeping me accountable became a big part of my life. And honestly, without the last C, the community, I don't think I'd be sat here today. Because it was a big part of this journey that I went on. And when I got through that first year, and I remember a few friends saying, right, what is it? What are we going to do? We're going to go out. Or a few friends even said, we'll go on holiday when you start drinking again. And, you know, people who are just know you for being a certain person. I then went through in the second year, the first 6 months of that second year, grieving an old me. And that actually probably was the hardest part of my sobriety journey, was that 18-month period.
I always ummed and ahed and shall I not? Maybe I'll come out, maybe I won't. But when I made a fundamental decision, like you said, a commitment to myself, but give yourself a structure.
Yeah.
That's what I do with people. Just give yourself a structure, an in and out, and a, you know, whatever works for you. So it's really smart you did that on your own.
Yeah.
It's really important.
It's so important. And I think it wasn't until I started to look back at how did I crack the code to this not drinking? You know, so many people say, how did you do it? And I remember thinking, if I can do it, this will be the making of me, like personally. And it has been, because it's allowed me not to be the bard in every room. It's allowed me to, like you said, center yourself, to ground yourself and own exactly what your values are.
Yeah.
And that commitment is knowing what your values are. And that has been a big part of this self-development journey, is every day check in. What are your values? What are you going to say yes to? And what do you have to say no to for yourself? And that's come with actually saying no to a lot of work that I essentially love doing, but isn't good for my well-being.
Yeah.
And that's been hard as well, navigating this new me. And when you do go sober, or you change your life in big ways, I do think you have to go through a grieving period.
Yeah, grieving's a really good word for it. How did you deal with the grieving?
I found it really hard, and I still do actually have those drinking dreams where I've taken a drink and gone, oh my God, I'm not sober anymore. I'm just nectar vodka. And I remember one in particular time, my brother came down. I mean, I was quite lucky that I'd spent a lot of my early sobriety in lockdown.
Yeah.
So there was no peer pressure. Again, would I still be sat here if I hadn't have had that on my side in a weird kind of way? But funnily enough, my partner drank more when I stopped drinking. He was drinking every day in lockdown. And he's not a big drinker. He's somebody who can just have the one and walk away from it. And so I found that quite interesting. But luckily I was able to just ground myself and get through it. But I didn't have the peer pressure around me. But the grieving process I found it hard. And I think even today, I do find that part hard. I think when you start standing up for what you want in life and really going for the life that you want, there's a void that's lonely. Mm. You get lonely because it means that you have to outgrow certain people who have been by your side a long time. And I've lost some really beautiful friendships and even relationships with family members. I found it very difficult when my brother came to visit in 21, like kind of summer 21, when we were allowed to kind of hang out with each other again. And and me and my brother were great drinking buddies. We loved to drink together. It was where we got our connection, and it's where we talk about our dad and our childhood. And I think he's had to rediscover a different sister. And we've had to, I think we've been through like this navigation, like unspoken. We've not even spoken about this. Like I'm saying this out loud for the first time. I've not even had this conversation with him about it. But I remember we were talking because I was turning 40 and I was talking about what kind of party that I wanted. And I just kept saying like, I don't want to be putting a party on for everyone else who wants to drink. I almost want to go out on an adventure and, you know, want someone to hit the trails with me and we can, you know, do something fun and different. But I ended up having this party to suit everybody else. And that was a big transition. And I remember my brother, because I'd said to my brother, I'd had this dream that I'd had my birthday party and we were having a drink. And he was like, maybe you just miss drinking and maybe go and have your birthday party and have a drink at your birthday party. And I was like, no, I don't want you to say that. Mm. I want you to be team sober.
Yeah, but
he's on his own journey, you know? And just because I'm sober doesn't mean everybody else around me has to be sober. But I did know that then things just were going to be so different with relationships.
It's such a powerful journey to go on. And it's such a rewarding journey in many ways because you're present most of the time. You know, with my children, I'm sure with yours, you're there, you're in the room, you're with them.
Yeah.
You can feel their emotions and see them.
Yeah.
And I think had I had kids when I was still drinking, I'd have just walked in and acknowledged them, been in the same space, but not been with them.
That's so interesting you say that. Because you'll know that more because of your own childhood, surely, like, you know, how present those people are around you. And I felt like that with my dad. I didn't ever feel very seen, or I remember it always being he'd make promises and never see them through.
Yeah.
And my two kids have had very different mums. One's had a drinker and one's had a sober mum. And I often feel quite guilty of being the parent that I was to Corey, like, and living a bit of shame because of that, because I wasn't very present. And he saw me passed out a lot, like on nights when I'd come home and drink too much, which is hard. It's hard to live in that. And another reason why people don't get out of that cycle, because you have those moments of guilt and then you think, oh, I'll drink again, just to get rid of that shame and that guilt.
That's a massive place for people to go back to drinking. What would you advise to people that are looking into stopping drinking like you did?
I think try not to overwhelm yourself. I think it's a good idea to take breaks. Start with a weekend if you can, or a weekday, depending on where you are with your relationship with alcohol. Is take some small steps and see what it feels like and reward yourself with a spa trip or, you know, a nice new jumper or whatever it is, you know, taking that time away and just make that time a bit longer and a bit longer. You know, so many people think that I cracked it overnight and I didn't. It took me a couple of years to get to where I was of tries and fails and tries and fails. And for me, that worked and I had to take that process. So definitely small steps, because it's so difficult to navigate this world sober. Mm. You know, it's on every corner. There's so much advertising. It's around friends and family. It's very, very difficult to, unless, you know, you're of a different culture or a different religion, to be able to live life easily sober. It's, you know, and I thrive sober and I love it now, but to navigate it in the early days is quite tricky. So small steps, I think, are always possible. And I often hear people go, I'm going to have alcohol in the house because if I can beat that, then I can, you know, make sure, you know, that means that I've cracked it. Don't get rid of it. Make your environment beautiful. Make it thriving with health and wellness and make it the best environment you can, because out there, you've got enough distractions. So make your home a safe space. So yeah, that'd be my big tip.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholfort and at this_ is powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Brian Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefield. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.